Because I was already deeply interested in Tolkien's spirituality, the idea of writing a biography centered on Tolkien's faith needed no urging. Holly Ordway.
Welcome to A Sacred Fellowship. This is episode 168, where your hosts, Catherine Olson and Lorianne Schwenk, are looking at a spiritual biography of J.R.R. Tolkien, published in 2023 by Holly Ordway. We are looking at these chapters as a way to see deeper into the writings of Tolkien and also through Ms. Ordway's spiritual reading to see ourselves more in Tolkien's life and work.
Take a seat in your own sacred reading space, even if it's your car, and join us. Reading in community is an essential part of what it means for us to treat a text as sacred, and we're glad you're here to continue building fellowship with us. We believe that by finding the sacred in this biography, we will learn to treat one another as sacred. Well, hello and happy Palm Sunday, Catherine.
Happy Palm Sunday to you as well. I'm glad to be entering Holy Week, or at least in
Yes.
our shared tradition, that
Yes.
is what's going on. But it's obviously different holidays for others, and we will address that later.
We will do that. Absolutely. Do you have a dungeon or a tower for us this
I
week?
have to say that my tower for this week was right after church. We
Hmm.
have a choir practice at 11:15, and because we were trying to do better blending, the choir director had us stand in a circle and sing at each other. And we've got this beautiful arrangement of Rejoice the Lord is King that we're performing for Easter services next week. And it was just really wonderful to see everyone singing their guts out and really expressing what the message is going to be. So I loved doing that, which we're usually just like listening to each other on different rows of the choir room. And it was a different experience. And then I would probably say that my dungeon is my sneakers are still very, very damp because I went out yesterday for an afternoon of enjoyment and did not anticipate how much it would be really pouring down rain for a lot of my walking on the way home. So I'm slightly, I wouldn't say mildewed, but I'm slightly recovering from that.
Oh man. Oh
How
dear.
about
Oh yeah, I was online with people in Vermont and northern or western Massachusetts, and they're still having snow in New Hampshire. So I guess you got rain instead, but it doesn't feel very springy, does it?
Well, that it's a, instead we actually had snow the night before, and I was actually up and found the younger child in my household had gotten up for some reason, and I brought him to the window and showed him that snow is so, still falling, and he was not happy about it being snowing. So the apparently he got his wish that it changed to something else.
Yeah, there we go. All right. Now we know. Now we know. Oh man. My real only dungeon right now is just that I have too much to do today and I'm not going to get to do it all. And so kind of feeling flustered, and I don't like to feel like that on a weekend. That's not fun. That's not fun. My tower, among many, thank you, world, is actually just how much I'm enjoying diving into this book. I'm just really grateful. And again, this is called Tolkien's Faith, a Spiritual Biography, published in time for the half century mark of his passing, Tolkien's passing, by Holly Ordway last year. And it is just a beautiful book. And we certainly recommend it. We'll be reading some from it. I know it is copyrighted material, but we will definitely read little bits that hopefully will entice you to read it yourselves. So that's my tower. Can you tell us about what a big day it is that both that we're recording on and also the day that we are going to be publishing this discussion?
Well, it is obviously going to be Tolkien Reading Day. If I'm not mistaken, is since I'm on the East Coast and England is several hours ahead, I think we're about to have it hit March 25th by the time we get done with this episode. And as many in our community will know, March 25th is a very important date in the Middle Earth saga. Specifically, it is the downfall of the Lord of the Rings, Sauron, and the fall of Barad-dûr. And that is why they celebrate Tolkien Reading Day. It says on the Tolkien Society website that it has been organized since 2003 to encourage fans to celebrate and promote the life and works of J.R.R. Tolkien by reading favorite passages. We particularly encourage schools, museums, and libraries to host their own Tolkien Reading Day events. We, of course, are none of those categories, but we are definitely going to be celebrating it in our own way. And today, a little bit in advance, we are going to be reading from this wonderful biography, as we said.
Right. So it's not necessarily one of Tolkien's works, but so much of his letters and his conversations and his books are quoted in it that I'm sure something will slip out. But we would certainly love to hear what your favorite passages are. What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think about a favorite passage? And I might post something on Facebook about that so we can all see what is delightful to all of us. And then we're calling this a spiritual biography because, of course, we all know there is the Humphrey Carpenter biography, and really another one isn't needed. It's even been reissued recently. So this is not that kind of biography. And even Humphrey Carpenter put it that we might have just talked about this child's birth, his upbringing with a single mother in New England, in England, sorry, his conversion to Catholicism, his time in the war, and then he got a job as a professor. And that would be all there was if it weren't for everything else. And I love that about this, that this was a man who had many interests and passions and just so happened also to write The Lord of the Rings. But a spiritual biography is a different way of telling your story, and it might not even be in chronological order. I have done one at least once a year for almost 30 years. And one way might be to look through a various cycle of something new coming into to my life, some kind of suffering coming in, some kind of new learning. And then what was that cycle like over and over and over again? Because we almost all experience that. Another way one could do it might be to tell the story of various teachers you've had, and to remember that a teacher might be actually the person who drives you crazy. Because finally, one day you wake up and realize, I'm just like that person. I do the same things that I'm mad at her for, or an in-law that you just can't stand. What? How is that person teaching you? So you're looking at gems on the strand of a necklace, not necessarily the whole necklace, but the different gems along the way where perhaps you had encounters with various teachers, and maybe it was an animal, maybe it was a trip or whatever. So there are various different ways of doing spiritual autobiographies. And I certainly recommend it, even if you do it just for yourself. But if you do get a way to share it, it's really wonderful. And so what I recommend is if you share with somebody, just listen. Let them tell their story from start to finish. And then when you tell yours, invite them to do the exact same. This is not the time for, oh, that reminds me of when I, or it's not the time necessarily for further questions. Let the person tell the story that they think is complete now. And then later there can be questions or follow-up or comparisons, but it's just a real gift to give somebody that chance. And one of the things about a spiritual biography, especially in this case, is since I trust most people listening are at least somewhat familiar with the life of the professor. And if you're not, it still doesn't matter. You can take Holly's book. I hope Ms. Ordway doesn't mind. I'm just going to call her Holly now. And read any chapter you want. And so we have picked four chapters for today that we think actually, in some way, speak to each other. We didn't plan this. You chose two, and I chose two, and they really paired up well. So I'm really excited about how this conversation is going to go. And that's kind of part of the spiritual biography process, because in the end, we're going to see ourselves in these chapters, we're going to see our other characters from books reflected in these chapters. We're going to see how this author, his whole life shone forth in what he wrote, and his faith is a big part of it, and that's what this book is for. And I think you're going to start for us with your first chapter.
Yes, and it actually the reason why I chose this first chapter is because of another spiritual biography that I actually read back when I was 22. It's called A History of Joseph Smith by His Mother. And Joseph Smith in my sect of Christianity is the founder of our particular religion. And so there are many things that have been written about his life experiences and also his own history of his experiences. But his mother's biography that I read back when I was 22 actually talks about her observations of how his parents and his siblings were formative in this as well, how the family culture led him towards certain personal inquiries, and also how it affected his own family life after he began searching out certain things. And so I enjoyed that. And so I chose the chapter that is called Mabel's Choice, which is then referring to his mother's conversion to Catholicism, as we know, or at least many of us know. Sorry, I'm trying not to explain that everyone should know that this is something that had an effect on Tolkien's life. He was very devoutly Catholic, but he grew up in England, and it talks about this effect in the opening paragraph that I wanted to briefly mention. It said, "In Victorian England, becoming a Catholic was not merely a private change in religious opinion or practice. It was of necessity a public act. Attendance and worship in the Church of England was part of middle-class social and cultural expectations, quite aside from an individual's personal belief. Once a person was received into full communion with the Catholic Church, he or she could no longer attend Anglican services. Not with a Sunday obligation to hear Mass, was it possibly merely to stay home and read spiritual literature. For a family member to, quote unquote, cross the Tiber, as the saying goes, was literally as well as spiritually a parting of ways." And so it's very interesting that, this comes into effect, and I appreciate the phrase of crossing the Tiber. It reminds me of the phrase of crossing the Rubicon, doing something that's unexpected and bold, but it has a definite consequences. Whereas crossing the Tiber just kind of refers to the Roman influence or the popization that they mention of going to the Roman Catholic Church. But it
Well,
says,
go ahead. Yep.
sorry, I'm trying. There we go. Tolkien, of course, did not go down that road. Is talking about it, looking at the problems of the Anglican faith, but Tolkien did not have a bitter experience with that. But it says that his faith was not a fait accompli, and it is for this reason that it is worthwhile to explore, as best we are able to give in the limits of information, the circumstances of his mother's conversion.
Well,
So,
I'd like to point out that he was old enough that it wasn't automatically assumed he would convert as well. He was eight, so considered into the age of reasoning that a 7-year-old would be able to make decisions like this. And so the fact that he does convert is significant. And go ahead then. Yes, what was your next?
We were talking about how we want to kind of see ourselves in this biography and relate to some of the experiences. And here comes another missionary story, though not a traditional one. When I was a new missionary in Palmdale, California, the first three people who I had taught who actually got baptized later were children whose family had already joined the church. But because they were at this age that they were expected to make the decision on their own and had to receive the missionary lessons, that reminded me of it, that this was something that they were of an age to seek out the truth and decide for themselves whether or not it was true to them. And so immediately with this idea of him having reach this age and this not being a done thing, as we can translate fait accompli from the French. I really feel like that is something very relevant, and I feel like every person, even if they are born into a family that has these traditions or these beliefs, has to have this moment of conversion. And so for me, it was really almost not exactly humanizing, but making him more relatable, that he went through a similar thing that we all go through in approaching our experience of faith.
In our maturing faith, right. And I think the
Go
thing
ahead.
that was reminding me, and I thought of Joseph Smith as well, because again, a choice gets made. There were lots of opportunities for being a Christian. He did not have to, create something new. He was called to, and then he had, he had to follow that. I mean, I trust that there was a choice he made, but I'm sure for him it felt like he had to. But when I think about Tolkien and the fact that he wrote for the dictionary and also translated the Bible, I think of another man who worked on the Encyclopedia Britannica about several decades before Tolkien ever wrote, at Leslie Stephen. And his choice was actually to be an atheist. And he, again, I mean, it was almost the same as choosing to be Catholic. He lost professional opportunities. He lost a stable career. He was shunned and all that. And so there's this bravery that I see in people not taking the safe path. And Leslie Stephen is the father of Virginia Woolf, just throwing that out there. So she grew up in a house that was completely atheist. And would have had no memory of ever going to church, but we see that Tolkien most likely would have remembered English services at the Anglican Church. He had such a good memory, he could remember the boat ride from South Africa to England. So he
I
certainly
love
could remember going to English services. So
that.
this was a choice.
I also really enjoyed the inclusion of the fact on page 25 of this book. This is a fairly short chapter, but it's really kind of full of information that is setting up so much. But it says that Mabel was recorded in the parish baptismal register as conversa ab heresi, literally as a convert from heresy. This was not an insult, but rather a technical description of how the Catholic Church viewed Anglicanism and, conversely, how the Church of England viewed Catholicism. And it talks about the fact that the term heresy, while its modern description is something very negative, comes from a word for choice. And so we're going to, later on in the book, at least in my second chapter, talk a lot about the choices that are made. And a phrase that comes up is thinking with the church, making it in decisions based on truths that you have accepted and the thing to which you are converted. But something that really struck me when we're talking about the idea of characters being seen through this lens, it reminds me oddly enough of Bilbo at Rivendell in Lord of the Rings at the Council of Elrond, because the part about the fait accompli reminds me of when they talk about who will bring the ring to Mordor. Bilbo automatically says, "Well, of course, it's got to be me." The Bilbo started the silly thing; he needs to finish it, and it is another person's choice to take up this burden. And there are so many people in the Lord of the Rings who take up these choices, who make this a commitment to something, and do it through an act of one kind of faith or another. And so, I really see that as something stemming from these very early examples of having to come from a place of conversion through a choice.
I like that. I like that. Though I think it's a little ironic that she had to choose to convert. So the very act of, quote, heresy, unquote, is how she did convert. And I actually make sure people understand today that our modern understanding of the word heresy, it should be choice and choosing. And I think that now that is less of a negative thing, even in one's faith life. I think there are choices that are possible. But I also noticed that there was an episode of Spivimi.
Oh, please point this out because I'm not sure to which point you're referring.
So it, Mabel and her sister both converted, but her
Yes.
sister was married, and her husband refused to let her go into a Catholic church ever again. So despite her choice, she had somebody who chose for her or would not let her make a choice, but Mabel had no such husband. So we don't know what would have happened if her husband was there. And so what we see is that one of these consequences of Tolkien's father being dead is that his mother is able to make this choice, which we know shapes this boy and man and author and professor. So.
That is a really good interpretation of that footnote that I just found that information in.
There you go, right? And I think that's one of the great things that Holly does at certain points is to entertain the game of, well, what if this or what if that? And there's a few of those that we'll come to later. Anything else for
Well,
you in chapter three?
to quote that Miss section, I just wanted to write it or quote something that Tolkien himself said that Holly brings up. It says that Tolkien wrote about mortality, or at least mortality from the elven point of view. A divine punishment is also a divine gift, if it accepted, since its object is its ultimate blessing. And the supreme inventiveness of the creator will make punishments produce a good, but otherwise, or sorry, a good not otherwise to be attained. So he himself is pointing out that this is a moment of spibimi. So that is all I had for chapter three.
Very good. And so now we're going to turn towards the latter part of Tolkien's life, when perhaps he might have expected to retire and have some quiet. But the timing of his life, it just so happened, it becomes the second half of the 20th century. And so we have on the cultural level, finally breaking free of the of all the difficulties of World War II. Finally, the economy is strong. And then there's, of course, the great explosion of the 60s in England. And you've got women can get birth control, shorts, skirts are shorter and hair is longer. And you know, music is different, so kind of culturally, it becomes very shocking. And what I love is that the whole hippie movement loves Lord of the Rings, and it's absolutely not something that this dear stuffy professor was in love with in return. And on top of that, the Catholic Church, the Church Universal, had its second major Vatican Council, beginning in 1962. He retired, Tolkien retired in 1959. And so some of the results of Vatican II are being open to more ecumenism. In other words, other forms of Christianity are not evil. You must not tell your classmate that she's going to hell just because she doesn't go to church with you. There becomes interfaith dialogue between among different kinds of Christianity as well as among different religions, meeting with Islam, with Jewish, with Orthodox, and even openness to the Indian continent and China and different religious expressions there. And the Latin Mass is shelved, maybe not everywhere. We have to remember too that Latin was a choice at some point too. Latin was the common, the vulgate. Latin was the language everybody knew, and so to cling to it, and we can talk about this more, but it just seems odd when originally that was the language chosen because that was what everybody knew. And so why not now have the mass be in a language that everyone can know? And I think what I love, we've got chapter 35 here. The tree is the thing. These were not easy things for Tolkien. He has, I don't like to use a term like conservative, progressive, whatever to describe him. He is who he is. But I love the title chapter, The Tree is the Thing, because I think what he sees is, yeah, sometimes a tree does need to get pruned or cut. Let's not cut it all down. Let's, but I think he could recognize, even if he didn't like the changes, he could understand the place of them. And that's where he again comes back to the elves, that the elves were the ones resistant to change. And because that they have the long, long, long lives that never end. And the men are always looking for this progress towards something new, something better, because their lives are so short and they want the next generation and the next generation to have something better. But he could see that point of view. And I think that's not as strong in Lord of the Rings as I think it could be. And it's certainly stronger in the Silmarillion. But I think that is, you know, when Galadriel talks about accepting that she will lessen and go into the West, that she is accepting that things are changing and she cannot change with them. And so I do love this chapter. Oh, we did want to say a little hello to our friend Christine. No further.
Yes, I was telling Lorianne earlier that this is such a good book that I have not dared to write in anything in the margins.
We both have first editions, and I'm not writing in it either. And normally I write all over the place. So I took a 2023 calendar and cut a bunch of bookmarks, and I'm taking notes, and I hope I can hold out and keep this book in beautiful condition. So, Christine, I hope you're happy.
Here.
Okay. So let's see, cultural strife, even motorways, which is just changing the landscape. Confirmations are dropping in all churches. Not just Catholic, but Anglican. Even in 1955, there's this discussion of changes made to Holy Week, and this is before the Vatican Council. And some people Tolkien knew were furious about this, but he actually understood it because it made Holy Week, which, for those who are listening to this right as we publish it on in March of 2024, that's the week we're in right now. And if you've got a job and a family, it can be tough to do all the things you want to do. There are certainly jokes and real concern about clergy during this time, because sometimes there are multiple services every day, and they're emotional and they're exhausting. Sometimes even there's requirements to meet with bishops during the week, or you know, it depends on the tradition. There's just an awful lot of emotion and work packed into Holy Week, and church musicians and people who take care of the church building, all of them. It's a really rough week. So I'm really relating to this idea that Holy Week might have been made a little easier for people in 1955. But I love how Tolkien himself equates reform with Saruman. And yet he doesn't want to be an embalmer either, and that's what he calls the flaw of the elves. And I relate this to crossword puzzles that always clue Eden as paradise, and we can't go back to the garden. Paradise, that garden is a future garden or a present garden, but you cannot put everything back to the way something was. So I love how he recognizes that he's in between. He doesn't want to be the elves, but he doesn't want to be Saruman. So I just love his acceptance of this in this very painful time for him. Was there anything for you in this chapter, or?
No, I think you've covered it. It's a
Okay.
really interesting thing. I personally was not as familiar with the Vatican II Council, and so this was a really good exploration of it for me. And of course, how this, I loved the Saruman comparison versus the elves, and so
Right.
I liked seeing that.
Well, he also calls the same comparison updating versus primitivism, and he sees the problems in both. And there's something we'll get to at some point where we see C.S. Lewis reviewing something of Tolkien's and treating it as a historical document, not as a poem that Tolkien wrote. And so I'm going to do this a little bit. We live in a world without hobbits. So even the hobbits are not permanent. And the hobbits are the ones who just want to be left alone and live in peace, you know. So they're not reformers or embalmers. They just want to do their thing. And so it's sweet that he really recognizes that The church itself is a living organism. It is a tree. And there's a phrase that I will use that I've learned from Richard Rohr, who is a Catholic priest that I've worked with in Albuquerque. And other people may have said this phrase as well, but I learned it from Richard Rohr, and called transcend and include. And I see that where you're able to move forward, but it doesn't mean the past is bad, right? So somehow or other, you're able to take along with you the things that you value from the past while exploring the things that are new. And I think that's the real gift. That's the real gift. It's now the age of men, in the fourth age of Middle Earth. And the wisdom of the elves will be remembered even if they fade and go west. just to continue the story. And at some point, somewhere along the line, hobbits will, get small again, and their territory will get small. And there might be one in my backyard right now, but I don't know. So it's how do we transcend and include? We have to look at what we value about those things, and see how do we keep those things with us presently. And that's what we do when someone we love dies. Why do we love that person? Why do we miss them? Be that. Did they always remember birthdays? I need to do better at birthdays. That kind of transcend and include. So I think that was all my notes on that. And I love that he uses a tree as a metaphor.
Yes.
Love it, love it, love it. All right, what was our next chapter? Were you going to start a bit of 38? And then we were going to go to 20.
Well, no, I think that
Okay.
we were going to have you talk about 20, and then I will include information from 38 as we
Okay.
go.
All right. So 20 is called Fellow Pilgrim. And this is about the friendship between Lewis and Tolkien, between Jack and Tollers. And it is what's funny is that Holly includes the origin of soccer in an epic way, because she talks about Tollers as a nickname, and Lewis liked to be called Jack. And so Lewis was called Tollers. Addison Walke became Adders. Radcliffe Camera, which is part of the Bad Bodleian Library, became the Ratter. Waste Paper Basket was the Wagger Pagger Bagger. Tolkien called the Martyrs Memorial in Magdalen Street called the Maggers Memugger. So this wordplay was very, very common. So rugby was called Rugger, and association football became soccer. So thank you, Holly. I love that. That's almost as good as Fingolfin and the origin of golf.
I think you mean golf and bowl.
Golf and ball. Yes, I'm not looking things up.
But
Sorry. Very sorry.
the entire thing with soccer does definitely reminds me of the Battle of the Green Field and Bull Roarer Took.
Bull Roarer took. That fool took. And so this is just lovely. This is this unlikely friendship. You've got this deeply Catholic man and this pagan who has kind of had a point in his life where he kind of thinks there might be a God, So, but they meet, and they each probably think the other needs a smack. But they continue to grow this friendship, and they're open to conversation with each other. And to me, that is true evangelization. If you come to me and tell me that I have to learn to love mushrooms, and then you tell me all these mushroom recipes and why mushrooms are so good for me, it's never going to work. Okay. But if you ask me about my favorite foods and I tell you, you'll learn something about me. Same thing here. These men were open to hearing about each other rather than telling each other how they were wrong. Oh, you stupid Christian, you should be an atheist. Oh, you stupid atheist, you should be a Christian. That was never going to work. So they listened to each other. And what I love, what Holly says, and it might be said elsewhere, but this was the first time I've seen it, that it is entirely possible neither man would have published their epic works. No, Tolkien had trouble finishing things. And of course, Lewis would never have written his great Christian allegories or his apologetics. without his conversion, which he credited to Tolkien throughout his life. He did read The Lay of Lethian about Beren and Lúthien, and this is where he was referring to it as a historical document, and he took on the role of four different scholars: Peabody, Pumpernickel, Schoeffer, and Schick. And each of those four made different comments and sometimes su suggested changes to the document. So this wasn't C.S. Lewis. This was Peabody, Pumpernickel, Schoeffer, and Schick reviewing this poem, which in the end never did get fully published, at least in Tolkien's life. I mean, we know Christopher got it out for us. We have it, such as it is. But it Tolkien took much of that feedback. And then, as Lewis is moving towards his faith, there was a nighttime conversation in 1931 with a friend, Hugo Dyson, and Tolkien joining Lewis at Magdalen College. And they're talking, they're just talking, they're outside, they're taking a stroll. And all of a sudden, the wind picks up. It's warm evening, and there's so many leaves flying that they thought it was raining. And they all realized this was an ecstatic moment. And so here is where this starts. Very few days later, I believe. Yes, a week after this conversation, Lewis passed on from believing in God to definitely believing in Christ and in Christianity. And that conversation had much to do with it. So what a gift. What a gift this friendship is. Let me see if there's anything else. And what I love is that Lewis struggled with doctrine. And I think one thing that Tolkien helped him with was showing that if it's okay with you in myth to accept this as a mythical story, can't you do the same thing with the Gospels? And that was the thing, to stop needing to apply such rigid intellectualism to the Gospels. And that's what I love, because myth does not mean it's fake. Myth contains truth. Myth is a way of telling truth through a story. And I just love that this was this meeting ground for these two through myth.
Well, I love the way that she puts it. It's from page 178 to 179. It says that myths were different from allegories, as shown in his response to the Lay of Lathian. Yet his pr approach to Christianity, this being Lewis, was essentially allegorical, not mythical. Lewis had been trying to understand the faith by translating it into another set of terms, a doctrinal, intellectual, systematic language. And then it says, Lewis realized was, sorry, the tremendous difference Lewis realized was that the Christian story was a historical, it was a true myth. Indeed, it was the true myth. It really happened. Or as Tolkien put it in the Gospels, art has been verified, legend and history have met and fused. And for me, I mean, this explains so much of why he tells a fairy story to give this sense of faith in Narnia to his godchild.
Yes. And then to me, I think that's also why Tolkien decides his creation myth will be in music, not in words right out at the beginning, but an unspooling of music. And I just appreciate that so much, because then it truly is myth, because you can't translate that into any words. And we can only imagine that music, and for all of us it will be right. My version of the music is mine and yours is yours, and so I know I'm going to be rereading the Silmarillion very soon, so I'm very grateful to that. Oh, I was just so excited in this chapter. Oh my goodness. In 181, Henry Newman, he refers to Henry Newman. And for those who don't know, Henry Newman was an Anglican priest and then experienced a conversion, and he went popish. He became a Catholic priest, and he is credited with starting the Oxford Movement, which helped the church do social justice and social good in the world. It helped with conditions in cities, working conditions, ensuring that children got schooling. So yeah, he did a lot of good. But I love what Henry Newman says here, Cardinal John Henry Newman. I am a link in a chain, a bond of connection between persons. Well, that's a fellowship. Thank you. And then talks about mythopoeia, which I'm hoping you and I will read together in the podcast at some point. This is Tolkien's great poem here, where he has 3 points to make. And I just want to address these quickly. First, he says the humans are estranged from God, but human nature still recalls its maker and draws wisdom. And this is the concept of natural theology. Second, we entertain wish fulfillment dreams. So where did we get that power to wish or dream? And Tolkien's answer is because we are created. So we can point to the fact that we have a creator, and we still make by the law in which we are made. And third, wish fulfillment dreams require us to judge between the fair and ugly, the right, the inappropriate, all of those things. And you know, I'm not into the binaries here, or certainly false binaries, but I do know that we do that. I mean, you know, we do that, and that means we have a conscience. So it is not wrong that we judge. This chair is comfortable, the wind is cold. You know, it's not always about good, bad, beautiful, ugly, but we do judge, and this is a good friend, this is someone I don't need in my life. That happens. That means we have a conscience. So I just wanted to point those out, and I might write something up about that soon. I'd be interested in other people's thoughts on those concepts. And then there's another instance of Spibimi. Tolkien was at a low point in his religious life in 1926. And as Holly says, it is not unlikely that the discussions and inevitable lively disagreements with his non-Christian friend over the next few years contributed to the gradual revitalization of his own spiritual health. And in explaining Christianity to an intelligent, thoughtful friend and colleague who would have challenged him, Tolkien would have found himself compelled to think more deeply about his own beliefs, what he held to be true, and why. Iron sharpens iron. That's from Proverbs 27:17. And so these two men helped each other and then gave each other, quite probably, their books. So there's some Spibimi, which is shall prove, but his instrument, if I'm talking jargon that people don't know. What was next for you?
Something that it really just struck me from that chapter of the Fellow Pilgrim was he comments that Lewis departed from his early Christian experiences with faith around the same age that J.R.R. Tolkien began to come into his faith. And so it's the same age of reason. And so them being on divergent paths did not make them antagonistic towards each other. They put them in conversation. It almost feels as though they had this long-standing relationship through the practice of Haruta at times.
And to have Ruta, right. Ooh, I just got goosebumps. Exactly.
Yay.
Exactly. And have Ruta is two friends learning together, right? Or friends learning together. And that's wonderful. And what an example too for all of us as adults. We never think we're done, to never think we're done, never think we know it all. Always be open, always recognize that we can keep growing. All right. Would you lead us into chapter 38?
I will, and the reason why I asked you to go first with your chapter about about Lewis, not Tolkien. All of this is about Tolkien,
Yeah.
but it talks about this is the chapter entitled "Companions in a Shipwreck," and it starts out with C.S. Lewis died in 1963, and with his death, the Inkling's social meetings in Oxford's pubs had come to an end. And it talks about a lot of Tolkien's later life, and especially his maturing of his views and his perspectives on certain things. So it is worth noting that this was deeply affected by the passing of Lewis. But this chapter also talks quite centrally about his views on marriage
Yeah.
through the lens of having just lost his wife. And so it said, Christopher stated that his, or as Christopher noted, sorry, misreading this as I put down a page, that his father had declared that the fundamental underpinning concern and concern of all his work was death. He was fascinated by the metaphysical implications of the fact that elves in his legendarium were not in their nature destined to die, whereas men are of their nature destined to spend only a short while in the world. And so the title of the chapter that it, and it is The Companions in the Shipwreck comes from his views on the position of husband and wife within a marriage. It says that without being centered on God, a man tends to make the beloved a kind of guiding star or divinity, rather than seeing that she is another fallen human being with a soul in peril. Women, he says, are companions in a shipwreck, not guiding stars. And so it says that in November 1971, Edith fell and ill and was taken to the hospital. 10 days later, on November 29th, she died. She was 82 years old, and they had been married for 55 years. I'm going to jump ahead to the end of the chapter now because of what is written about the inscription on their gravestones that feel familiar. And the story of Beren and Lúthien and the Silmarillion offers us an important insight into Tolkien's understandings of marriage. Those two names are engraved on their shared tombstone in Wolvercote Cemetery. I never called Edith Lúthien, he told Christopher after Edith's death, but she was the source of the story. She was, and all knew she was, my Lúthien. It is certainly a story of great and persistent love, but we should not miss the fact that it is also a story of great tribulation. Both Beren and Lúthien most repeatedly display precisely those characteristics that Tolkien said to his son are guides to marriage in a fallen world: prudence, wisdom, a clean heart, and fidelity of will. And so this chapter for me a lot has to do with going back to the idea of the conversion through choosing that we were talking about in chapter three, specifically the section on page 350, where we say Tolkien subscribing to what it says, sentire cum ecclesia, which is a Latin phrase coined by Ignatius of Loyola in his spiritual exercises. It means thinking with the church. And to be in the right frame of mind as a Catholic, we must put all aside all judgment of our own and keep in mind the ready and prompt to obey in all things the true spouse of Christ our Lord, our Holy Mother, the hierarchical church. And I love this phrase as a framing device for the other things that he says, both to his children and in responses to C.S. Lewis's views on marriage in his work that later became the book Mere Christianity. And it's so something that he wrote to his son Michael with advice about marriage, this being Tolkien again, cautioning with him that the tradition of chivalry, which idealizes the man as a knight in shining armor serving his perfect lady love, is a good insofar as it encourages fidelity, self-denial, courtesy, honor, and courage. But it has a serious weakness that in that even a Christianized chivalry is not perfectly theocentric. And so I love this idea of what we can learn from chivalry as well as what it is, what its shortcomings are. Sorry, I'm looking for a quote.
Well, I think our some parts of our culture have put so much emphasis on marriage as somehow just holy in itself that that I think has gone to that part that he's talked about, that kind of chivalrous, where it's just the two focused inward on themselves, rather as seeing it as this base from which these two might serve the world in some way, or serve their God if that's who they are. And I think there's so much talk about, well, once you're married, that's it. And there's almost like no
Yeah.
support if it's difficult, no support if it's a problem. And I mean, you see Tolkien, he's of course opposed to divorce, but did he ever talk to a battered woman? Did he ever talk to, someone whose spouse had run down the bank accounts and committed fraud or something like that? That there are times when the marriage is not working and must end. So I'm always mindful of making marriage itself an idol, and I like that he wants to be theocentric. But I also realize there are times when the person being theocentric must walk away.
Well, there's a wonderful quote on page 352, again, writing to one of his children. It's that in a right letter to his son Michael, it is a fallen world and there is no consonance between our bodies, minds, and souls. Marriage may help to sanctify or direct to its proper object of man's desires. Its grace may help him in the struggle, but the struggle remains. And it says, he emphasizes very strongly to Michael that it takes deliberate, conscious exercise of the will and self-denial to be faithful to one's wife in mind and body. And in that last phrase, we can see Tolkien's holistic understanding of fidelity as it expressed in Jesus' teachings. So I mostly enjoyed this chapter for just the utter relatability of his views on marriage, and they could be seen as very sermonistic at times. I mean, it draws heavily on a lot of scriptural or doctrinal things, but on the other hand, you can see how deeply it is rooted in experience and in the long toil that in the partners go through.
And so while his mother made the choice to think with the church, I think that was the phrase, right?
Yes.
He chose a life where he has thought everything out for himself. And that's the person of faith I really appreciate, is the one who does not blindly follow a doctrine the way someone else tells them to, but is able to question it and think about it and evaluate for themselves, is this right? Is this right for me? Is this something I can live with? Or even if I don't agree, can I respect that other people do? Or or on that line, I think that that's a very wise faith that Tolkien shows. This is not blind, no blind obedience, and that to me is what in the end Aragorn realizes is the only way he will become king. He can't just walk in and tell everybody, you just have to believe me. He's got to earn it. He's got to show them with the various signs, the symbols, the actions. And then just in the end, people just love him. They want him king. It's not, women lying in bogs randomly handing out swords.
No basic system of government.
Right. It's no system of government. Right. Oh, this has been really fun, and I hope folks enjoy this and read the book and comment on the chapters yourselves. And we do hope sometime to have Holly as a guest. We didn't give her enough time to join us this time, but we really hope that we will have Holly at another time where we will go deeper into the book and into her own love of Tolkien and everything like that. Next episode, we're taking a week off. The Easter is just going to be busy all around, but we will return with more sacred readings and conversations in April. We promise.
And we love hearing from you, and our community is growing stronger every day. If you'd like to join our Facebook community, please look for A Sacred Fellowship. Find us on Instagram at A Sacred Fellowship. You can also send an email to asacredfellowship@gmail.com. Thanks to all of you for keeping our spirits up and our thoughts flowing. Please read and comment on Second Breakfast at our website, www.asacredfellowship.com.
And we also value the contributions of our Patreon supporters. Your support of the site and hosting costs is much appreciated. If you feel inspired to join their ranks, please look at our options on www.patreon.com/asacredfellowship. Perks have ranged from patron shout-outs to literary themed presents, and we appreciate every dollar.
And in closing, happy Tolkien reading day to all, a holy Ramadan to those fasting, a happy Easter to those observing Holy Week, and a happy Pesach to our Jewish fellowship later in April. Whatever you observe as spring gets underway, we hope your roots and branches are strong and flourishing. Namarie.
Namarie.